Hello. We on? Okay. Memorial Day weekend. Exciting. It's a beautiful weekend. You know, I always thought it was funny, you know, they moved the Memorial golf outing up a week or because it always rains this weekend. And now this weekend it didn't rain. Now watch it rain next weekend. And that, huh? So, yeah, beautiful weekend. I guess no one has to worry about rain on their parties and picnics and that kind of stuff. Today, we're going to take a break from the Gospel of Mark. We've been in that series, we're in that book, teachings, over the last several weeks, and we're going to resume that next week, so don't fret there. We're going to study a passage in the first letter to the Thessalonians written by the Apostle Paul in chapter 5. And it's a letter that we studied through last year thoroughly, but it was a teaching that we had to skip due to some weather problems, where we had some weather run through and we had electricity problems. We couldn't actually meet that weekend, if you guys remember that, some of us. It's a great subject. You might not think so at first, spiritual leadership, but there's some very interesting insight when we get into this that God is trying to tell us. So hopefully we can explore that this morning and get into that. Start with verse 11, chapter 5, 1 Thessalonians. Therefore, encourage one another and build up one another just as you are also doing. That's a pretty cool place to start, I think, you know, especially for Memorial Day, right? A good piece of advice. You know, we're going to be with friends and families, and you want to what? Encourage people and build people up. Sounds pretty cool. Ironically, though, in this letter that Paul is writing, this comes on the heels of a section where Paul affirms to these guys that there is going to be an end to the world that we know. I think he says it like a thief in the night, that, you know, it's going to end. That God's going to have to come in and step in to stop, in the future sometime, to stop humanity from totally annihilating each other. Utopia in this world system. You know, this idea that everything's going to get better will never happen according to the Bible, like some people would love to believe. I mean, it's a good thought, but it's not going to happen. So for us then, just like these guys as Christians, even though the end of human history, as we know it, will indeed end according to the Bible, we, as children of God, have an eternal hope that will never end. In fact, Paul makes this point in the prior couple verses, verses 9 and 10, if you will. For God did not appoint us to suffer wrath, but to receive salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ. He died for us so that whether we are awake or asleep, we may live together with him. And so the Bible teaches, you know, that God is going to rescue all of his children and ensures eternal life in heaven for everyone, forever. I think in John 10, it says, you know, Jesus says, nobody will snatch any of you guys out of my hand. And so on the heels of this is where Paul throws in this therefore, right? As we're living in this broken down world, headed for destruction, sometimes misery all around us, if you just watch the news, to remember the hope that God has for us and to encourage each other and build each other up, because the world can be a pretty harsh place to live sometimes, you know, as we all know. As we walk with the Lord, you know, you're going to find yourself both on the receiving end and the giving end of this command to build each other up and to encourage. So as we go further then in this section with Paul, Paul then is giving some very practical advice on ways in which we can accomplish this command. Now, probably as we read, there's 11, some people say as many as 15 different imperatives and instructions in rapid fire that Paul gives here with different angles and different emphasis. Now, we're only going to focus on 11 through 13 for most of the day, but I want to read 12 through 22. It's a pretty quick read to just get a good feel of the context that we're going to be in. And so in verse 12, he says, "But we request of you, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor among you and have charge over you in the Lord and give you instruction, and that you esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Live in peace with one another. We urge you, brethren, admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, and be patient with everyone, so that no one repays another with evil for evil, but always seek after which is good for one another and for all people. Rejoice always. Pray without ceasing. In everything give thanks, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. Do not quench the Spirit. Do not despise prophetic utterances, but examine everything carefully. Hold fast to which is good, and abstain from every form of evil." I mean, do you feel the passion, the intensity here? Maybe the vision of Paul as he's, you know, his vision for a vital, engaged body of believers? This is an awesome reference for us as we sometimes, you know, find ourselves, you know, off course a little bit, derailed, bogged down as we're serving God and serving people. To remind us of some of the, you know, back to the basic precepts and concepts and ideals of Christian living. Very practical ways to encourage and build each other up. And this, this obviously infers in the context of close community. Because you're not going to do any of these commands, you know, out on your own, doing it by yourself. You have to get close enough to people relationally to know how to build each other up and to encourage. And so that's the context in which we're going to read today. And I want to go back to 12 and 13, where we're going to really sit for a second, most of the day here, and reread that. He says, "We request of you, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor among you and have charge over you in the Lord and give you instruction, and that you esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Live in peace with one another." Now, isn't it interesting here that Paul starts this section of encouraging and building people up by holding up the leadership team of this group, having their back, if you will, you know, emphasizing their importance in the group? I mean, this group, probably less than a year old, it was established by Paul himself on his second missionary journey. But he was not around with them very long. If we remember the when we were learning, reading in this book last year, he was thrown out of town 3 to 5 weeks into the ministry by a Jewish mob. He probably thought that this group didn't even make it, because that's not a lot of time. But he's writing back to these guys now because he has learned that they are flourishing in their faith, even though they didn't have the instruction that, you know, he would have liked to have given them as newer believers. And so these guys, again, probably less than a year old, probably less than, you know, not very large, probably less than 100 people, something we might be able to relate to here in this group. And he's addressing everyone in the church here, not just the leaders. Now, that's interesting also. He says, "We request of you, brethren." In verse 27, later on in the chapter, a little further than where we were or where we stopped before, he says this, "I charge you before the Lord." That's strong language. "To have this letter read to all the brothers and sisters." And this is what, you know, when we read this, you know, he says this instruction is for all the brothers and sisters. And as we read this today, you know, that's our mindset. We should be in a mindset, it's addressed to all of us here that claim Christ as our Savior, you know, that claim to be part of a group and this body of believers. I mean, this is one of God's instructions, like so many in Scripture, that is intended to be heard and acted on, you know, way beyond the intended audience that it was written to. And so just as for them then, us today, this isn't just for leaders and people of a select few people of position to figure out what it says and then go out and tell the people. This is for everyone. But what's he asking the brethren to do first? Interesting. He says to appreciate those and esteem them very highly, the leaders that are among you. I mean, though it's addressed to the brothers, the brothers and sisters, he's pointing out that there are ones among you that have been called out by God to be leaders among you and to work hard, to teach, to lead in a leadership role, to give direction, to give instruction, to make decisions possibly that are a little tough at times. And so what does that tell you? First principle, God's into leadership in the church. In fact, it is a God-ordained ministry of the church. And, you know, God appoints leaders in our lives, if you will, for our benefit. God delegates leaders within the context of the body. He's probably the originator of delegated authority. You know, a lot of time to speak his truth and his love into our lives. This is one of the primary ways that God interacts with us personally, through other people, and especially through the leaders of the groups that we're in. Now, there's a lot of subtle points here that I want to examine, and I think that we can learn and grow from here this morning. And first of all, notice that he states those and them in the plural. Those that diligently labor among you. He's not addressing the brethren to appreciate a person as a leader, but he assumes multiple leadership. And I already made the point, right? Probably less than a year old, probably less than 100 people. And Paul here is assuming multiple leadership, even in a small group like this. Plurality of leadership, where you have multiple leaders within a church body, with similar or equal authority, making the decisions. It's taught all over the New Testament. In fact, every reference in the New Testament concerning leadership emphasizes plurality. Even when Paul is writing to and addressing Timothy and Titus in those letters as individuals, he's actually, you know, addressing different qualifications for them to look for as they appoint leaders within their prospective churches. Terms like elders and deacons in the plural. It's never in the singular. Now, you could argue that God was okay with single leadership in the Old Testament. You had leaders like Moses, and you had Solomon, you had David, you had the kings, right? That led the nation of Israel, kind of God's point man, if you will. But the paradigm shifted drastically with the emergence of the church. As the church came onto the scene, I mean, even Peter and Paul, you know, significant figures in the New Testament, you know, led with multiple leaders in the early church. And even on their missionary journeys, they had multiple leaders. In fact, Peter, in his first letter, when he was writing chapter 5, we have verses 1 and 2. He says, to the elders, plural, among you, I appeal as a fellow elder. There's equality. And a witness of Christ's sufferings, who also will share in the glory to be revealed. There's the hope. Be shepherds, plural, of God's flock that is under your care, watching over them. And so why am I making a big deal about this? You know, you might be sitting here this morning and just thinking, you know, that's obvious. You know, plurality, that makes sense. Well, not so much in the world. You know, somewhere in and around the second or third century, the church's mentality shifted away from true plurality, true plural leadership, back to a concept of single leadership, where you have the pastor or the priest or the bishop or some other, you know, singular office in the church structure. It's still the majority view today in the modern church, where you have one guy at the top of the pyramid or his sphere. You know, the pastor or the priest again, who runs the show. Now, you might have an appearance, if you've been to a traditional church, you might have an appearance of the offices of elders and deacons, right? Within those structures. But most of the time, or a lot of times, they're just puppet titles. They don't have any real influential authority, very little substance to their leadership role. The real authority is with the one guy or the one girl, you know, that's over everybody. And this has been the paradigm now for centuries and still is, again, a real problem within the church today. And the question that comes to mind, why do you think God emphasizes, as we're learning today, plurality of leadership within the church? Why do you think it's important? Well, first of all, you got accountability. As human beings, we are all fallen. We all have a fallen nature. You know, even on our best days and our best efforts, you know, we run down roads that often we shouldn't be on. You know, whether we're leaders or not. And if one person is making all the decisions and, you know, and doing all the direction setting for the church body that they're in, there's nobody to keep them in check. And so when they run down that road, who's going to say, no, don't do that? Multiple leadership allows diversity of thought, especially when you're thinking about accountability, right? To those, you know, those erroneous thoughts, those bad decisions. Now, granted, it's not foolproof. Now, multiple leadership can be led astray also. I mean, we have examples of that in church history, but common sense and statistics show that it's less likely for multiple leadership to be led astray as opposed to single leadership. Which leads to the next point, which is safety. You know, multiple leadership. God, you know, it's important to God for the safety of his kids. We're his kids if you've received Christ. God has an enemy in this world, and so do we. We also have an enemy. And this enemy has great influence over humanity. The Bible calls this character, this real spiritual being that's brought up over and over again in the Bible, Satan. He's not a fictitious character like a lot of people want to make him out to be. He's real. And Satan isn't his name, it's a title. It means adversary or opposer, who opposes God and anything to do with God. And if you're into God, then he opposes you. And one of the primary tactics that he has in attacking is to divide and conquer and to separate people out of the pack and devour them. If you look at Peter again in 1 Peter 5, verse 8, he says, "Be alert and of sober mind. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for somebody to devour." And we know how a lion hunts in real life, right? What's he do? Separates its prey out from the pack and goes after the lame one or the one that's alone and attacks them. And so when you think of the concept of single leadership, a person potentially separated out, sometimes isolated because, you know, he's made himself that way because nobody knows what the heck he's doing. He's way above everybody else. That person is a very easy target for this world and for Satan to take out. Multiple leadership strengthens the cord. You know, I've heard it and demonstrated many times. So I went out in my backyard and I picked up some twigs. And you ever heard of this example? You guys probably have. But if you put a little bit of pressure on one twig, harder than it looks, it breaks. Right? Doesn't break all the way. It's too alive. But if you take 10 twigs and you band them together and you just put that same amount of pressure, it's not going to break. I mean, it's not impossible, but it's not going to break. There's strength in numbers. And there's a degree of safety that we get against the evil one and against the influence of this world in our lives when we engage in multiple leadership, when we lead in the church. Multiple giftings is another one. Right? Bible teaches that each one of us who receives Christ into their heart or into our hearts receives at least one and most likely more than one gift from God to contribute to the body that they're a part of as a whole, to the functioning of that group. And this is for the whole. Oh, there we go. Sorry. This is for the whole body, whether you're a leader or not, the promise that is. And so it would certainly hold true then for the leadership as well. The single leader would be limited somewhat, maybe to a large degree, to what he has to bring to the table. You know, when he comes alone. I mean, he might only have the gift of gab. Multiple leadership would assume many more giftings, right? The availability of many more giftings at the leadership level. More leaders, more giftings. Makes sense, right? Which means, you know, there would be more ideas and for solving difficult issues that come up. You know, giftings like encouragement. I mean, I have a couple people doing that. There are people that are in gifting in evangelism, teaching. Couple that might be vision-minded, that's leading the church. But someone that's, you know, a couple that are in, you know, that have the gift of patience. So when we try to get too far ahead of ourselves. The gift of faith when we're in despair. And so the point is, the more giftings, the different giftings, balance out the leadership team as we're moving forward in this world. Brings more diversity and creativity to the group. More points of view for us to handle the variety of issues that we're going to handle, that we come up against. I mean, if you don't know, people are pretty messy. And be sure the people that you serve as a leader, if that's your role, will be extremely diverse and creative in the issues and the problems that they have and they come up with. So be ready for that. Avoiding man-centeredness. Now, we see a lot of this in church history. You know, with the traditional church and now over the last several decades with the mega churches that have come up on the scene, where you have a lot of people attending churches, seems like a lot of activity, but not a lot of substance. The focus is on the leader, the leadership, one charismatic leader at the top. People following, you know, some gimmick, a person, the buzz of the day. Something happens to that guy or girl at the top, what happens? Total chaos. And we've seen that happen where thousands of people have no leader at that point because there's no one behind to fill in the shoes of that person that was leading. Now, Xenos, you know, this group that were right here, if you just go by the numbers, and you wouldn't notice it here today, but, you know, we're part of a group that meets in this city. We could be considered a megachurch. Just by the numbers in its own right, by outside people. I mean, throughout the city, we have over 5,000 people meeting in teachings like this one, and or, probably more important to us, you know, in home church meetings, meetings in the homes. You know, throughout the week, you know, same people, most of them meet also throughout the week. It's the heart and soul of our fellowship. It's what we hang our hat on. And one of the main differences between us and other churches in the world is plurality of leadership. We don't have just one guy at the top leading the show. We have churches that come in and will examine our model and say, how do you do that? Volunteers. I mean, our structure, if you don't know, and just to get a little bit into it, from the top down, we currently have 10 teaching elders in our church. 10 different people with equal say and authority, providing accountability, providing the safety and the diversity of thought, the variety of different giftings to bring to the table. Now, they're put up by the leaders, but they're confirmed through vote by the, I'm going to bring up a big biblical term here, the deacons. And the deacons here in our church equates mostly to the home church leaders, which is one of the most amazing facets of our church and definitely the strength of our church. Each home church itself has multiple leadership. I think we have, over 200, both adult and college ministries right now, home churches in this city, ranging anywhere from 15 people to 50 people per home church throughout this city. And the leadership in the home churches, it's not puppet leadership. These aren't titles. They all have extensive training, proven years of service with the Lord and serving people. They all have credible influence in the church itself, both in their respective home churches and in the upper decisions of the elders. They're very involved. I mean, just last month, I went to a meeting. We have an annual meeting for the home church leaders and the leadership of the whole church. And some of us here went up to Sandusky, and we had over 800 leaders, and not everybody was present in one room, praying together with a vision for what we're doing in this church and in this world for our missionaries around the world. It was overwhelming, it was dynamic, and it was powerful. It runs a chill up my spine when I think of the wealth of knowledge in that one room. I'm telling you what, there are churches triple the size of us that don't have that many leaders. That's almost a fifth of our church. And the point is, the leadership of our church here is very aware of man-centeredness religion. Very aware of it. A healthy church needs to be centered in God. And not just in theory, but in action. Not man-centered, not gimmick-centered, not buzz-centered, but centered in God. Now, just a final thought on this particular topic is that availability, right? As a church grows in numbers, the single leadership model becomes less and less personal, right? The availability of that leader becomes almost non-existent just because it's a numbers game. And that's a substantial concern for the person attending that particular church, because most people are there because of the leader, the lure of the man. And so with plurality of leadership, your immediate leaders or your home church leaders, are readily accessible to you on a regular basis. We meet two or three times a week. The home church leaders, not the elders, are the ones that marry and bury, typically, if you will. But they organize, works of service. They prepare and provide teachings and encouragement, admonish and correct and lead the group and in these areas. And that's the way it should be in the model that that God gives us in the Bible, if you're following biblical teaching. Now, let's change direction a little bit. Let's tackle this notion that may be sitting wrong with a few of you as we read through this. When Paul makes this statement of the leaders, having charge over you, I think it could freeze our minds a little bit, right? We need to get that one out on the table. The Greek word here is proistimi, and I probably may butcher that, but it means to cause, to stand before, to set over, to be over, to preside, or to rule. I'll be honest, right? When you hear this phrase, to have charge over you, don't you twist in your seat just a little bit? Get a little bit uncomfortable, a little bit uneasy? I mean, let's face it, as Americans, you know, we don't like anybody to have authority over us. If we had it our way, we would want to be totally independent, totally autonomous, not worrying about anybody. And if we expand that out to all of humanity, this makes up a good portion of the root problem between humanity and God in the first place. According to the Bible, you know, we told God we didn't even want him over us. And so we rebelled and decided to go our own way. You know, that's the separation between man and God, the main crisis of the Bible. And so that twinge in your belly that you might have, that, you know, when we read that phrase, have charge over you, is really inherent to who you really are as a human being. It's part of the human experience. We're fallen human beings. You know, it's funny. Some of the modern translations that we use here in this fellowship that we respect. First, the NLT, the New Living Translation, this is how they put it. They work hard among you and give you spiritual guidance. They completely leave the phrase out. They skip over the word. The NIV, the newer version of it, who work hard among you, who care for you in the Lord. These are weak translations, in my opinion. You know, and I just wonder, you know, is this a response to the growing anti-authoritarian attitude over the last several decades that this world has come across? You know, that we don't like this idea, you know, of somebody over us. That it's actually crept into our biblical translations, possibly. Could be a reflection of this attitude, as we're seeing here somewhat. I mean, make no mistake about it. The word is the word, to cause, to stand before, to set over. It's meant to be read that way. If we bring in another passage from the book of Hebrews, it says, Hebrews 13, verse 17, have confidence in your leaders, plural, and submit to their authority because they keep watch over you as those who must give an account. Not pretty. Especially for us that have problems with authority. And I'll submit to you that if you allow this anti-authoritarian, cynical, contemptuous attitude to spill over into your spiritual view of leadership in the church, it's gonna hurt you spiritually, individually, and it's going to hurt the body that you're part of. Sometimes to the point of divisive. Because think about it. You know, if God has put spiritual leaders in your life, and you, I guess if you accept that premise, you have to do that first. But if you ignore or discount that advice or that input, or you're overcritical towards your leaders, that could be very damaging to your walk because God may be trying to get your attention through them. And you're opposing them. Now that doesn't mean that you have to blindly follow any spiritual leader in the church. That's not what God calls on. Leaders are fallen human beings also, and we made that point. And they're subject to error, and they're subject to even spiritual error while exercising their leadership role in the church. And sadly, it happens. And occasionally we come across that even in our church. But there are teachings about that also in the Bible. And we're not going to spend a lot of time on that, but God does call on us for a level of discernment by the individual, by you, towards your leaders. Calls on us to challenge erroneous teachings and bad advice that we come up against. Leaders are not infallible. That's why we have plurality of leadership. God does not want us to just blindly follow people. That's not what it's saying here. But generally speaking, we should have an attitude of following leaders that God puts in our lives and he puts over us. People that we come to respect. We might not always agree with them, but we come to recognize, you know, that the person is a viable, godly leader by the fruit of their labor and by the way they conduct themselves and the way they, the way they dedicate themselves to God. And couple that with having the understanding that, again, this is an avenue that God uses to get through to you, to speak his love into your life. You should have a general attitude to follow the leaders that God puts there. Now, this is where the tables get turned up a little bit or turned on its head a little bit and a little bit more clarity comes in. You might still feel a little uneasy about this whole notion of someone having charge over you in the church. You may have come out of a bad background, you know, where you're out of single leadership, where people are non-accessible. You didn't really get the leadership or possibly bad leadership. I mean, it's all through the church, some of the things that are going on. And there's a key element that I've left out on purpose till now to make us squirm a little bit, to think through this. You know, do you buy into this, having somebody over you in the church as a leader or not? Something that we should consider. And the key here is to not read the phrase "have charge over you" through the world's lens, like we look at everything else, but through the lens of God and biblical teaching. What does the Bible say? What does it mean in the Bible to charge, to have someone or to have charge over someone? And first of all, what doesn't it say? Jesus, speaking in the book of Mark, chapter 10, verse 42, calling them to himself, Jesus said to them, "You know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them." Rulers of the Gentiles, the world's view of authority, pushing and prodding and trying to get ahead. We see this in today's world, in throughout history, power versus subordination. That twinge in your stomach when you hear having charge over you, you know, submitting to potentially oppressive authority in your lives. Jesus isn't into that either. He goes on in 43, he says, "But it is not this way among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be slave of all." That puts a little bit different slant on it. I mean, the Bible's mindset about leadership is servant love. Whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. The idea of sacrificially giving or leading by being a servant to the people that you are leading for their good versus lording it over them for your good. I mean, that changes everything. And again, that twinge in your stomach should be starting to subside a little bit and going away because, you know, biblical leadership, if it's based on servant love, you know, then this idea having charge over you actually becomes a tangible benefit for you because the motive is taken away other than love. I mean, now it's not perfect here. We're fallen human beings and we're trying to follow this model, but it's the paradigm that we should be trying to follow if we're following God's instructions as a godly leader to serve the people that he's put in front of us. And again, especially when you realize this perspective that God is speaking to us through the people that he puts in our lives, especially the people that are leading you and serving you. Then he says this in verse 45, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." You know, the number one purpose for, you know, for God taking on human flesh in the person of Jesus Christ was not to lord over man in the worldly sense, but it was to serve man by becoming a sacrifice for the sins of humanity. This idea of ransom here, you know, is this idea of buying back. When you buy something, namely something that was lost. And humanity was lost because of the rebellion, our rebellion against God. You know, remember, we didn't even want God's authority in our lives. But the Bible declares, you know, if we look at Paul writing to the Romans, chapter 5, verse 8, he says, "But God demonstrates his own love towards us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us." While we were enemies of God, you know, heels dug in, steeped in our rebellion, he died for you and I. He died for all of humanity. And he bought us back. He paid that ransom. He redeemed us. All different ways of saying the same thing. So that by our own free will, that we can opt back into a relationship with him. Not by the works of our own service, but only by his mercy and his blood. And he clarifies this in verse 9. He says, "Much more then, having now been justified by his blood, we shall be saved from the wrath of God through him." Remember where we started today? The coming wrath of God at the end of time. Again, the Bible declares that there's going to be an end, that God will judge. And the wrath of God, you know, will be unleashed on mankind. But the good news to reiterate is, you know, leading up to our passage today, is anyone that receives God's offer here of free salvation will be saved from that wrath. And God offers this to anybody that wants it, that will say that I want that free gift to apply to me, that I want Christ dying on the cross for the sins of humanity to personally apply to me. Which insinuates then that you accept his leadership in your life. Doesn't it? I mean, that wouldn't you say, I'll have you, God. I'll have you, God. Be my leader, be my God, be my Savior. And this is open to anybody that has breath in their lungs that can say in their heart, I want this to apply to me. And if you're here today and you've never done that, it's not good enough to just go to church. It's not good enough to be born into a family that was religious. You're not going to heaven based on your mom and dad's faith. It's a personal decision for anybody that says, I want that to apply to me. And God says, in a nanosecond, I don't even know what that is, but very quick, God says, I will come into your life and start a relationship with you, which will lead you to eternal life that is secure, and no one can snatch you out of my hand. I urge you to make that decision if you're here and you've never done that. Spiritual leadership. What do we learn today? God's into leadership. We learned that first. Servant leadership, not worldly leadership, not lording over. That's important. Multiple leadership as opposed to single leadership. We learn that. Multiple leadership, what? Offers of accountability, diversity of thought, safety against Satan and the schemes of the world. Multiple giftings accessible to us, avoiding man-centeredness or religion. availability to your leaders. Now, there's plenty of facets of leadership within the church that we didn't get to. One is it's hard work. You need to count the costs. You know, I mean, if we look at that diligently labor among you, if we tore that down a little bit, that means to toil. Something to consider. What does it take to be a leader? That's a question that might be in your minds. You know, how do we be, how do we as a body recognize leaders? That's another question. Things that we can talk about in our smaller groups. That's what they're for. If we're interested. Obviously, we just didn't have time today to get into all that, but very important. So just to read it one more time. But we request of you, and we, do you see that? We request of you. Here's Paul writing, and he's saying, we, as multiple leaders, request of you, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor among you and have charge over you in the Lord and give you instruction, and that you esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Live in peace with one another. Don't squabble and argue at every point and every turn. That's where we'll end today. All right. First time guests. Anybody here for the first time? We have a couple books up at the Welcome Center. It's a booth over there on the wall. We'll have somebody tending that here in a minute. And just stop by there. It's free of charge. And they're both great reads. As far as good information about God and what God's doing in this world. When you came in today, you got a pamphlet. And in that pamphlet, there was a welcome card. And that's for anybody. It's not just for new people or new guests. Any comments that you have, whether it's good or bad, negative, what you like, what you don't like. Put it on there. Put it in the bag as we put it. Send that around. We do send a bag around for the giving of the church. If you're a guest here, please pass that on by. Accept our hospitality. We don't want your money. That would be rude. Oasis, we have the kids until 11:45. It's another 20 minutes. So we're going to have some question and answers. Our question and comments that we're going to do here, and some prayer, and afterwards, don't feel like you have to rush to get your kids. Hang out and talk a little bit. Let's see here. First thing, questions. Anyone have any questions or comments about the teaching today that might have crossed your mind? The paradigm or the mode of operation here is you raise your hand, we'll bring around a microphone, and I'll see if I can answer or any of the questions that you might have. And I wasn't that thorough. There was a lot of questions out there. Come on.
A comment. It's on. It says it's on. Is it on? Can you hear?
Right, there we go.
A comment, not a question. No question.
Okay.
That in our culture, right, we all have this autonomy so richly entrenched in how we operate, how we think, how we live. Even in a church like this one that stresses this different view from God, this servant leadership view, this need to be relationally tight that way in the church, I think. We have to go there continually. We have to beat it like a drummer keeps the band in time. It's, you know, we have to, guys like you, all of us, have to hear that message, have to repeat that message. I mean, it's not the kind of thing, I don't believe anyway, that we can hear once and say, okay, I get it, now I'm going to do it. It doesn't work like that because there's so much pressure continually to think in those autonomous terms, to live in those autonomous terms that kind of unity that you were stressing today just falls apart.
Yeah, very quickly, by the way. It falls apart very quickly if you're not continually beating that drum, like you say. And I agree. I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, our fallen nature wants to be autonomous and a part And I think it is difficult, and it's something that we should always be talking about. This is not something that we just learn one time and we got it, per se, because it's very easy to get, I'm doing all this work and nobody's appreciating me and all this stuff. And, I mean, you hear that all the time. I mean, I hear it from myself in my own heart. And I got to give that over to God and realize, and it goes back to, realizing the eternal hope that we have in Christ Jesus and going back to the cross. And great comment there. Yep, absolutely.
I just wanted to speak to the leadership and having someone over you and stuff and leading you. I know when I first started coming to Xenos, I might have thought that home church leaders were that was it. They had arrived at some level of perfection. And then when people would talk about them, honest to goodness, I remember being in a class and somebody was whining about their leaders, and I was like, what? How could they do that? They're supposed to be perfect, and it has been a process for me to understand that even as my home church leaders have requested things of me that I, at the time, did not agree with, but to realize that they are still growing, they are not perfect, they are in a position that God put them in, and to respect that, realizing that maybe I don't agree, but to go along because they are the leaders. Because just like you said, Satan would love to divide us. And many times in my heart, I had felt I would be justified if I just walked away from this. And it's like, you know what? Who's the loser here? And that would have been me. And I just encourage anyone here who is in disagreement sometimes with their leaders, just hang in there because they're still, learning and growing too, and they need our support, and they need us to continue to pray for them. So thanks for the teaching too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was a good comment. A lot there, and I do agree though, as far as I think, God's teaching both the leader and the person that's being led. And a lot of times, I mean, all of us should be a leader in some capacity, at least in life. And most of us should be in the church. I mean, we should have a leadership role of some capacity, doing something that we take the point on. And there's always an upward look and there's always a downward look so that we have both perspectives. Because, you're going to find that, you're going to give some instruction to somebody that you're leading that's not going to like what you said. That might give you perspective on what you demand of the person above you. So, yeah, it's just one of those things to get involved in the church body and to really understand what leadership's all about.
Thank you for your teaching this morning. I was rereading this morning the Ten Commandments out of the Bible, not off a billboard or anything. And your lesson today, taught through Paul and again through you to us from God, reminded me very much of some of the mega churches, some of the churches that we grew up with that have gone astray. And what Paul was warning against was directly God's rules, the Ten Commandments, that there's a fine line between respecting and worshiping. And some people get confused and they worship their church leaders, and then they are directly against the commandment not to have other gods. And one of the things I see in the really big churches that are very wealthy is that they fall into coveting one another. And they have to have the biggest building and the nicest things and the largest programs because someone else has it, not because it's to raise up and to worship God and to bring Christians to the way. It's because there's another competitor. And I think that today it really resounded with me that a lot of what Paul says in his many letters and a lot of what we hear in the New Testament is reiterating what God has been saying all along in the Old Testament, that go back to the basics, go back to the commandments and the covenants and the laws, and you're still expected to do that. You're still expected to live with that. It's just maybe in a more modern language for us to hear.
I'm trying to get around a lot of what you said there, and I agree with the idea of not worshiping the leader. Oh my God. And that happens in our culture all the time. And unfortunately, why would you do that? And quite frankly, there's a lot of reasons I think why people do it, and one of them is they're lazy. People would rather have someone tell them what it says instead of going and find it themselves. They're too busy in the other parts of their lives. I think it's just a lure that Satan takes out. You know, and that leader may have had good intentions right off the bat, but when he got that praise and worship, and he's the only one making the decisions, all of a sudden he's on a tangent, and nobody's there to stop him. And so, yeah, I was shaking my head, not disagreeing with you. I'm just trying to figure out which way to go with that. So, yep, thanks for that comment. Great.
Thanks, Jeff. I remember years ago, I'm not going to say how many, but
just a couple.
I went to different churches because I didn't like the ones I went to. It felt like everybody in the church was there to be a recipient of whatever the minister or whatever they call themselves. It's like, okay, I'm going to be sitting here like a bump on a log being fed. And there wasn't any aliveness, if you will. And so I just, after a while, gave up. There's no point in going to church. I don't get to react. I don't get to participate. And I went to this church, of all places. It was in a funky warehouse someplace. And it's like the guy up there was saying, "Don't believe me. Check it out yourself." And he was reading to us, teaching us the word. And it's like, wow, this is different. And the people in that church, they were relational. They were getting into the word itself and talking about their personal lives and how the word affected them and how this relationship thing was, you know, it just seemed so exciting to me. It's like, wow, what happened here? And so I'm kind of dismayed to see all these mega churches, and it's like they have this epitome of a charismatic leader, and the people there look like they get there, they go there once a week, and that's it. It's like, okay, I've done my part. I'm religious now. And
right.
So I really appreciate your time and efforts to give us the word there.
Well, thanks. But I mean, just to bounce off your comment there, you know, going after the gimmick and the buzz, you know, a lot of people want that chill up the spine, you know, like they're going to a concert, and that's why they're going to that particular teaching, is because they get that buzz, and when that buzz is gone, there's nothing left. So there's no realness, that at least in my opinion. So.
Jeff, thanks for the teaching. And I was just contemplating, you know, other areas of our lives where this is true, where these principles of leadership are still present. Are you a parent? Guess what? You're a leader. You got two kids, or we have two kids that are looking towards us, towards leadership. You know, and how we lead will have a profound impact on them as they grow up. You know, are you married? You two are leadership. And working between you two, if you don't have kids or whatever, or if you do, that's even more paramount on the decisions that you make as a couple, that these principles still apply and are very, very useful. You know, a couple that is willing to sacrifice their lives for the other, you're going to have a very vibrant marriage. So these principles, I think, or even in the workplace, are you a manager? You're a leader. And how you lead your people can also have an impact on their lives as well. So I think it's just not enclosed within the church, although what you taught about was, I think there's some applications out there that still apply beyond the realm of just believers, what we would recognize as leaders within the church.
Right. Well, and you know, I mean, what, 4 or 5 decades ago, totalitarian leadership was the way it was. You led with an iron fist. And now over the last couple decades, a lot of the books you read is on servant leadership. Isn't that interesting? You know, the whole concept of the Bible kind of coming out into the workplace. Unfortunately, they warped that also for their money. You know what I mean? But even then, I mean, it's still it provides a better place in the workplace, a lot of places that we work today. So, yeah, it creeps out. But I think it's, you know, it's God's perspective that people don't even realize that they're following God's perspective a lot of times. So, all right, got a couple minutes to pray. And I'll tell you what, does anybody want to pray? Like has a desire to pray one, and I'll back it up. If not, I'll just close it up. All right, I'm just going to close it up. I just didn't want to squash on somebody here. Well, Lord,